Ladies and gentlemen, we are now beginning the conference call. If you get disconnected during the call, please call 1-888-409-6709. Again, the number to get reconnected is 1-888-409-6709. At this time, your line is muted and will continue to remain muted during the conference. To ask a question or if you have a comment, please press star 0. If at any time during the conference you need assistance, please press star 0. I would now like to introduce Meredith Dodson, Director of U.S. Property Campaigns, located in Washington, D.C., to open the call.
Great. Thank you. And hello, everyone. Greetings from Washington, D.C., and I want to offer a special welcome to our call for anyone who is joining us for the first time. So, as you probably know, it's been a very busy set of few weeks already here in Washington, D.C. After years of drawn-out work, Congress has finalized work on the massive farm bill. This is the bill that's really critical for our work in 2013 and spreading into early 2014 to protect nutrition programs, especially SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Program, formerly known as food stamps. So after years of work, the House passed the final farm bill on January 29th by a vote of 251 to 166. And the Senate approved the legislation on this past Tuesday, 68 to 32, and the President signed it into law yesterday in Michigan. So the final bill does cut SNAP by $8.6 billion, reducing SNAP benefits by an average of $90 per month for 850,000 households. So I just wanted to start off our call really acknowledging what has happened with the Farm Bill the last few weeks and giving a little bit of context before we get into our action this month. So ultimately, results, we did choose to oppose this legislation because we believe it will make it tougher for thousands of Americans to put food on their tables. And we need to remember that real people are impacted by these decisions. And to help us kind of keep that in mind, I wanted to share some words of some of the Witnesses to Hunger, the organization that helps those directly impacted by poverty get, have their voices heard, share images, et cetera, and share what they how they've described what cuts to SNAP overall mean for them and their families. So this is a woman named Jewel. Quote, any cut to my food stamps would mean a great deal to my family. My youngest daughter is 5 years old and has severe food allergies to wheat, eggs, peanuts, and tree nuts. To keep her healthy and safe, I need to buy her food from specialty stores, which costs a lot of money. With the cut to SNAP, it will be even more of a struggle to make sure she gets the food she needs. And in that process, I will have to make tough choices, taking away from some of the money I allot for food for my other daughter in order to feed her. Taking food away from one mouth to try to feed the other, it's terrible. And if I can't get the proper nutrition, I'm of no good to either one of my daughters. Another, Tiana, sharing her her story about SNAP cuts. Quote, if SNAP is cut, my husband and I won't be able to put enough food on the table. It is already really hard because each month you run out of your food stamps. More cuts mean that my husband and I may miss even more meals to ensure our kids do eat throughout the month. So again, cuts to SNAP have a real impact on millions of people. At the same time, I want to highlight how much worse this legislation, the Farm Bill, could have been. So remember that the House budget proposal last year proposed $130 billion worth of cuts to SNAP. And last fall, the House passed a $40 billion cut to the SNAP program. The House legislation that they passed last fall, as you all know, would have ended up kicking probably well over 4 million people off of the program. And while we oppose the final farm bill that just got put into law, it does not actually remove anyone from the program. It just deeply cuts benefits for some of the participants. Honestly, the final farm bill is a much better outcome than I would have predicted we get out of our campaign work. And in particular, I want to highlight the work that you all did to push back on some of the proposals that would have gutted the SNAP program and removed millions off the program. So in particular, you all met with at least 83 meetings with members of Congress. You met with them face-to-face over this past year to educate them about what was at stake. And you met with hundreds more congressional offices and talked to thousands, I bet, made thousands of phone calls to Washington, D.C. And you did a bunch of really amazing media work, 155 media pieces, including many that you generated going into the new year, demonstrated broad support for SNAP. And in particular, I think this media backlash against the extreme House proposal and highlighting the automatic cuts to SNAP that happened starting in November, it was critical in getting the final legislation to a place where it does not remove anyone from the program. So again, we at Results were disappointed that Congress just passed this legislation that will make hunger worse, but your work was critical in saving access to SNAP for millions of Americans. So now we're looking forward to 2014. In the last few years, we've had to play a lot of defense, protecting critical programs like SNAP and Head Start and the Earned Income Tax Credit from cuts, and pushing for them to be expanded where there were opportunities, and we've had some success in that. So defense is good, and as my colleague Josh will note, you should ask the Seattle Seahawks, the winners of the Super Bowl, about that. But now it's time to play some offense again. It's time to be more proactive and moving closer to our goal to ending poverty rather than reacting to the next threat down the pike. So we're in a process now of proposing kind of formal campaign to the board and hope to update you about that next month. But I want to highlight a particular opportunity you have to push for policies that will really move us towards ending poverty in America. So advocates from around the world are coming together to embrace a broader goal of ending extreme poverty by 2030. The president of the World Bank, Dr. Jim Kim, has been a leader in putting forward this goal, and he'll be speaking at our international conference in Washington, D.C. That conference is June 21 to 24. In addition to Dr. Kim, we'll be joined by the founder of the Children's Defense Fund, Marianne Wright Edelman. We'll be joined by columnists David Bornstein and Michael Gerson from the New York Times and Washington Post, respectively. And we'll have a dynamic panel repeating something we did last year because it was so moving, of those with true expertise on poverty in America, those who've experienced it firsthand and know what works and what doesn't. And we'll also have a panel of economists who can provide context based on policies and impact policies can have on poverty. We'll, of course, offer top-notch advocacy training and prepare those folks who are coming for powerful meetings with hundreds of congressional offices, including many meetings directly with representatives and senators. So here's what we need. We need your voices to build a groundswell for really ending poverty in this country by 2030. And coming to our conference is a fabulous opportunity to be a part of that. The conference is also an opportunity to introduce new people to Results and our work. And as we shared last month, we have an exciting fellowship called the Real Change Fellowship, specifically for young activists and potential new young activists to develop leadership. So I really encourage each of you to come and invite and bring someone new to the conference. Help us really expand our reach and impact. So the registration is now live at results.org/events. And the early bird registration rate will be active through April 6th. So now let's switch gears to focus on our action for this month and our fabulous guest speaker. So as many of you know, 2014 marks the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, and there's a lot of focus on how far we've come as a country to address poverty for millions, and yet how far we need to go. And we believe at Results that if America truly wants to live up to the ideal of the American dream, that anyone can have a fair shot at being a success, people need a shot at moving up the economic ladder. For our work, this can include that low-income Americans should earn enough to make ends meet, that they need to be able to stay on their feet and not be punished for their success, and build and save for the future for themselves and for their children. So we'll review some possible policies that can move us in that direction later in the call, and they're obviously outlined in our action sheet. But our focus this month is to educate our communities and our policymakers about poverty in America and opportunities to instigate real economic mobility by generating opinion pieces or op-eds in our local newspapers. So let me introduce our fabulous guest speaker, Margo. Margo is a repeat guest here at Results. She's also spoken at our conference. And she is the principal of DuPont Circle Communications, which is an 8-year-old full-service communication firm specializing in writing opinion pieces, opinion editorials for nonprofit organizations. She's assisted authors with opinion pieces that were published in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Boston Globe, Politico, Huffington Post, and many other outlets. She also leads workshops in editorial writing and is presented with a bunch of different places, including I know some of you have seen her at the Results Conference. And she has a great Facebook page that, if you look back through, has a lot of great suggestions. It's called Op-Ed Talk with Margo. And I urge folks to check that out as a resource. And Margo previously served as Vice President for Communications at the National Women's Law Center. She was Deputy Director of Media Relations for People for the American Way and a campaign coordinator for the first marriage equality referendum in the United States. So as you can tell, Margo is one of the real leading experts in thinking about how to highlight our issues in opinion pieces. And Margo, thanks so much for being on our call today.
Thanks, and thanks for all the great work you guys are doing.
Oh, our pleasure, especially when we get to work with someone like you. So I'm going to ask a series of opening questions, and we'll open up to questions from our volunteers. So this month, we are urging groups to get op-eds published using the hook of the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, but also on the other hooks. You might have some ideas on that. And using that to talk about expanding economic opportunity and building ladders out of poverty. So just to start us off, for folks who maybe aren't familiar with media advocacy, can you explain what an op-ed is and why they're so important?
Yes, and it gets harder to figure out among editorials, letters to the editor, and op-eds. It gets harder to figure it out every year the more people get their news online and visually can't separate these categories like back when we used to have more focus on print. But if you look back, if anybody still gets a print newspaper or sees one at their library or whatever, editorials run down in the back two pages of the paper. Editorials run down the left-hand side of the page, of the back page, and those are written by the editorial board of the newspaper. You normally will not see, there will normally not be anyone who signed them. And that presents the position of the people who actually work at the newspaper and the editorial board. Now, the other two things are what we're interested in. And on the opposite side of that editorial page, there are op-eds, which could be written by folks like us, could be written by policymakers, could be written by anybody in the community. And what I like about op-eds, columns written by regular folks or experts in their field, what I like about them is when you are involved in a news story, as you guys know, a journalist is going to go to the quote-unquote other side to get the other side of the story and include that in your news story. So, you know, it's not an ad for your position. It's not a straightforward presentation of your position. It has, you know, both sides or multiple sides. But when you write your own opinion editorial, you completely control the message. You completely say exactly what you want to say, unfiltered, uninterrupted, for a good, 650, 700, 750 words. In a lot of papers, in between those two, in between editorials and op-eds, will be shorter letters to the editor. And the main difference there is they are shorter. Maybe they're 150 words. Maybe they're 250 words at the maximum. But the main difference there is a letter to the editor is most of the time, there are some exceptions, but most of the time they're in response to something that's already been published. So you kind of have to wait to respond, whereas an op-ed, as you said, you can be on the offensive. Why they're important is because your congresspeople, your state legislators, all the opinion leaders in your community read these and care about what's in them, and this is one of the ways they get their information, and it's a fantastic way to supplement those great face-to-face meetings that you were describing earlier, to have a face-to-face meeting, but to have this be in the media, the context, you know, that these articles and so forth are running that week, the week of recess, when your member is home or when he's meeting with you, it provides a really powerful context, the soup that you're swimming in.
I love that soup that you're swimming in. And for folks who can't tell, I'm typically taking notes during the call. Can you all hear me?
You're a little hard to hear, Meredith.
As people can tell, I'm taking notes, or perhaps you can tell the click, 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 I'm taking notes, so I want to make sure we capture that soup that you are swimming in. So apologies, folks, that I had to capture that last piece before we went on to the second question. So So the second question I would have for you, Margo, is what would you recommend that results volunteers do, perhaps even before they start drafting their pieces and after they've submitted it, to make sure that it gets published or at least increase the odds?
Yeah, I think putting some thought in at the beginning is a great idea. You know, one of the main things to think about is sometimes people jump into writing and then they finish and they say, well, where will I place this? And you might want to think about placement before you start writing, because it might affect the tone or the style in which you write. You know, if you're writing for an old school mainstream newspaper, you might be a teeny bit more formal than if you're writing for, you know, a snarky local political blog. Both of them are powerful, but your writing and what you say might be different. So you just want to think about it before you sit down to write where you're going to try to place it. I think the most important thing to answer before you write is, what's my answer to why now? Why now? Why is this publishable now? Because that's what the op-ed editor is going to ask. It might be a great idea. It might be very interesting. But it's still, you know, the word new is still in the word newspaper. The word new is still in the word news. So you're going to have to answer, why is this important now? Well, you might, some of those hooks might be very, might roll out very obviously throughout the year. For example, you know, one of these great proposals that's described here in our materials, you know, one of these great proposals might be proposed that day, might be proposed that week. So it might be a great time to say, you know, this new piece of legislation that could solve a lot of problems has just been filed or is about to be filed tomorrow or whatever. So that answers why now beautifully. So I think that is the hardest thing, is the answering why now. So the 50th anniversary of poverty is definitely a hook. I do fear that as the weeks and months of the year go on, it might feel like less of a hook because it got a lot of attention in January. So you just want to be constantly creative and constantly on the lookout for what could be an effective lead. New research that has come out, new statistics that have come out. Every single month, first Friday of every month, the job numbers come out. That provides a hook. That provides statistics that you could jump onto. Holidays and anniversaries. Labor Day is an obvious time to talk about jobs and poverty. Mother's Day might be a time to talk about, women raising their families, low-wage working women. References to popular culture might be an answer to why now. I wrote one last year when the movie Promised Land came out with Matt Damon about fracking. That gave us a chance to talk about fracking. Because we could talk about the movie and pivot to the real promised land of real communities that had been affected. Unique personal experiences, you've actually experienced some of these issues firsthand, the way Meredith was reading Jules' statement and Tiana's statement and different folks. Starting with those, if you've had those experiences, or starting with personal stories of someone you've worked with, their personal experiences can be quite grabby. Those are a little evergreen. You might not need as much of a why now. So those are some of the things you can do to constantly being fresh, constantly looking for hooks that make your placement timely that day or that week. The second part of your question is what to do after you submit. After you submit, you definitely want to do a follow-up call. You definitely want to do a follow-up call. Just because, you know, we all get countless emails a day. Some of them go into your spam filter. Some of them you see and you say you'll get back to later. Remember, when you're submitting, it is still an email and somebody can miss it. So you want to call, try to reach someone live, make sure they got it, and then gauge, do you have any interest in this? Do you have any space for this issue? And you might be able to get them to read it and engage with you and give you an answer about whether you're going to be published, while you're still on the phone or a few minutes after you've called. I've had experiences where I've called an op-ed editor and they say, oh, let me look, I'll get back to you. And 20 minutes later, I got my yes or my no. And that yes or no allows you to, if you get a no, to move on to another outlet.
Great. Thanks, Margo. And anything you would say in your experience or somewhat in addition to some of the things you already covered are essential components of a good op-ed?
I do think the lead and the hook, which we just went over, is really – it's always the hardest thing, and it's always the most important thing. The broad other component that I think we as nonprofit advocates need to think a lot more about is creating – you know, what Oprah used to call aha moments. In other words, if you write your op-ed and it's sort of a rehash of the conventional wisdom or it's something that's been said before, you're not really, you could have trouble getting published, A, but B, you might not be changing people's minds because you're not causing them to have an aha. You're not causing them to say to themselves, gee, I never really thought of it that way. And a great op-ed, and this is how I gauge what I think is great. You know, I was a couple months ago, I was reading there was the issue of The Right to Die is back in front of the New York Times today, but this gentleman was talking about a Right to Die referendum, and he himself had a degenerative disease, and he talked about, is it really the person's decision? I have looked into my caregiver's eyes, and I've seen how weary they are, and I could have felt like making the decision to end my life would have been caretaking of them, would have been releasing them of this of the obligation of taking care of me. And it was before I read that op-ed, I was like, yes, everybody has this right, and everybody should be able to autonomy. And then I thought about, gee, there's all kinds of dynamics that I don't know about because I've never been in that situation. And it was an aha moment for me. It shed light for me that I hadn't really thought of before. So try to come up with aha moments. And so we've got your lead, and then add – so common, really essential elements, good lead that we discussed, maybe add a personal story, the real mom that we discussed, add in a personal story, add in some data that proves your point. You guys are great on picking out recent data. And then really focus on solutions, which in the sample that was given out touched upon a bunch of ideas that could make things better. So, you know, I like to think of these things as sort of half problem, half solution, like describe the problem, but then get to solutions. And think about always trying to spend more time, more space on solutions than the problem. So maybe 300 words describing the problem and 400 words describing your different proposals, either describing one proposal in depth or describing, you know, four different proposals or whatever that becomes your agenda after the board looks at that. But one thing that looked like an aha moment, at least to me, coming from the outside and reading some of these materials for the first time yesterday, one thing that kind of excited me from the aha perspective was the idea of low-wage entrepreneurship. I thought that was really interesting. And I could see that taking off because Democrats and Republicans can both agree and get excited about that. And I could see a scenario where, you know, in that before you write mode that we were just talking about, maybe one of, you know, the advocates on the call decides, well, I'm not the best messenger for that. I actually know a low-wage entrepreneur. I actually know a low-income person that got some training and you know, some small investment and was able to then support him or herself with their own business. And maybe that person could byline the op-ed with your help. So I see a lot of exciting possibilities for that one. And I also thought what was kind of interesting that I had not heard about before was the cliff effect, the abruptly cutting off benefits just because you were starting to do better and suddenly your benefits have to go away and instead decreasing them. So those are some ideas that, you know, maybe they've been around for a long time, but they felt a little bit new to me as someone who's kind of one step removed from the front lines.
Great. Thanks, Margo. So I think we have time of your game for let's take one question and then we'll see. We might have time for two. Well, it depends on how it goes. So, operator, can you give instructions?
Yes, ma'am. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that is star 1 for a question.
Great. And while folks contemplate that, I just want to remind everyone we have the slides available for the conference call at our homepage, results.org. You can download them in the top right. You can see a beautiful picture of Margo on slide 5, but also, you know, the recap of what we've covered already with SNAP and some great slides we'll be using later on in the call. So I wanted to mention that. Operator, do we have anyone in the queue?
Yes, ma'am. You have a question from Columbus.
Okay, go ahead, Columbus.
Hi, everybody. This is Jenny Vokes, and I was just interested, Margo, in your saying if you get a turn down from a paper, you can go ahead and submit your op-ed to others. We were hoping to submit to several papers in our state and in our area to have a better chance. What variation has to occur in the op-ed to make that legit?
You're saying you wanted to submit the same or a similar op-ed to multiple papers?
Similar, yes.
And how different does it have to be?
Yes.
You know, I don't want to give you bad advice. I know that among the national papers that I work with quite a bit, it really has to be pretty different. But maybe on the state level at smaller papers, the standards might be a little less stringent. But you can certainly use the same data. You can certainly use the same, obviously, policy asks that you've settled upon. You might be able to use similar hooks, like everybody could write on Mother's Day. But if there's something unique, like maybe you'd want to vary the personal stories.
Right, right.
Yeah. If you could mix it up little bit, I think you'll be okay.
And different authors, of course, would.
Yes, absolutely. But
okay.
Yeah, but we definitely don't want it to look like, a template was used without any editing or filling in.
Okay, great.
For one reason is we don't want this to ever look like, you know, what's called an AstroTurf campaign, that it wasn't an organic bubbling up from the ground floor, that it was something orchestrated.
Mm-hmm. Great, thank you.
Margo, do you have time for one more question?
Sure.
All right, and you can answer it on the brief side. Do we have another one in the queue?
Once again, if you have a question, press star 1.
Okay, it looks like here in D.C. we actually have a quick question, so I'm going to turn the phone over to Results Volunteer Bill Schickler.
Hello, Margo.
Hi.
In social media, LinkedIn has a section called Groups, and I've put some things in there. It's a 200-word entry, and you can put in a little attachment which might refer to something in another paper or another news story. I don't know if you have any experience with this. Do you think putting stuff in LinkedIn business groups is a waste of time, or do you think it's helpful?
Margo, maybe I could add on that just any other insights on social media generally.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm far from being an expert in social media, but I think all of that is worthwhile. I think it's always worthwhile, and LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, the new ones that are popping up, I mean, that's how people are getting their news now. They're getting news from their trusted business colleagues and sources. You're finding out about things from friends instead of opening the paper every day because there's just so much information. You use your friends as gatekeepers. Meredith, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the data from the, you know, I point back a little bit to the data from the Congressional Management Foundation that, you know, how much influence they put on social media versus how much influence they you know, direct communication from folks in their district, especially face-to-face meetings or even new news editorial, you know, other coverage. I still think it matters more to do the print media, but I think social media is a really great strategy for some of our groups where you're really thinking about how can we kind of comprehensively get this, as Margo called it, the organic bubbling up. So, hey, this is appearing in the paper, and, you know, it's going viral on, you know, the most influential political blog in the state, or, you know, and I think also, quite honestly, you can, social media is a good way to promote, and I don't think you have the same dangers of, you know, you can submit something, you can post on social media an op-ed that you've also submitted to a paper, and it's not a one or the other thing the way the previous question alluded to. So I wouldn't start with social media, but it's a good additional strategy in addition to going for the, you know, the print media that's going to be most influential with policymakers. Great. Well, that's my two cents on it. But thank you, Margo, for being on our call, and thanks, folks, for your great questions. And as we bid Margo adieu, we'll transition over to Joss to overview our February action. Joss, are you there?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yep. So thank you, Margo. And
thanks.
Here we go to Iowa.
All right. Good afternoon, folks. As Meredith said, I'm going to overview our February action and our training for the month. So this month, you know, obviously the action is that we're going to be using the media to get the conversation started about expanding economic mobility in America. As we've talked about, 2014 marks the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty, which is, as Margo said, is a great hook, at least currently is a good hook to get the media's attention. So we want to start the year off strong this year and build on the great media success you had last year. So our goal is to get 15 op-eds printed in the local media outlets around the country this month. So if you look on slide 7, you can see that there's some talking points there, and these are contained in the February action as well, that give you, you know, a place to start with. And so, you know, just to highlight a few of the talking points in there, if you're writing your op-ed, you could start off talking about the war on poverty and the programs that it created, like Head Start and Medicaid and SNAP. You could then share a personal story, maybe how these programs have impacted you or someone you know. Then you can transition to say, you know, the war on poverty has had great success, but we're not finished yet, and now we need to move forward and not retreat on our commitment to end poverty in America. And what would that look like? Well, that could mean making sure that families have what they need to make ends meet, expanding the earned income tax credit, investing in social entrepreneurship, as Margo said, raising the minimum wage. Those are all things that can help people earn what they need. We also need to make sure that families can stay on their feet. As Margo mentioned, you know, this idea of the cliff effect, where people, you know, have a modest rise in income and then they end up losing more in benefits than they gain in income, and we actually send them further back down the economic ladder instead of empowering them to move up. And you can see the slide in the PowerPoint, I believe it's slide 9, that shows kind of a graphic of the cliff effect. So making sure that they, you know, can, you know, stay on their feet while they're moving up. And then finally, you know, you could talk about if we want to really end poverty, we need to plan, help folks be able to plan and save for the future. The financial security credit, which is a matched savings account that's targeted toward low-income taxpayers, would be an excellent start to do that. So you can find these talking points in the PowerPoint there. You can also find them in the February action, along with some other good background information. And we even have a sample op-ed in the action sheet itself that you can use as a template to write your piece. So take action this month. Take time to draft an op-ed about the war on poverty and our need to expand economic mobility in America. You know, tell readers that when families can earn what they need, stay on their feet, and save for the future, we all succeed. And we encourage each member of your local results group to submit an op-ed. And we also recommend you be strategic in whom you submit it to. instead of everyone in your group submitting it to the same paper, pick and choose different outlets in your in addition to your local paper. You know, looking for other papers in your state or weekly papers, alternative papers, radio and TV, and popular blogs. The key is to get the message out to as many outlets as possible. And, of course, Results U.S. Poverty staff, Meredith and I, are also here to help you. In addition, our Results Media Support Team is here to provide you coaching and support in your media advocacy this month. You know, the team is made up of Results staff and volunteers who meet each month via conference call to help our volunteers generate media on our U.S. poverty and our global poverty issues. And this month, we're excited that Results Deputy Director of Communications Colin Smith will be a featured speaker on the call to help you work on this month's U.S. poverty action specifically. So the call is Tuesday, February 18th at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, and you can find the contact information, how to call in. It'll be in our weekly update next week, as well as in the results events calendar on our website. So now let's move into the transition into our training section of this month, and this starts on slide 11. And, you know, the idea of this training, we thought would, a good thing for this month would be to give you a refresher on poverty in America and the war on poverty. And so for this month's training, instead of a laser talk, we're going to do a quiz, the War on Poverty quiz, which starts on slide number 12. So get your papers and pencils ready, and, you know, let's do this all together. And no peeking at the answers ahead of time. Otherwise, you get sent to the principal's office. So let's start the quiz on slide number 12. So question number one, by whom, when, and where was the unconditional war on poverty declared? Was it Lyndon Johnson in Birmingham, Alabama on April 15, 1964? Was it Sergeant Shriver in Washington, D.C. on June 1, 1964? Or was it Lyndon Johnson during his State of the Union address before Congress on January 8, 1964? All right, if you've got your answers down, scroll to the next page, and you can see that the answer is C. Lyndon Johnson declared the war on poverty on January 8, 1964 during his State of the Union address. And you can actually see the quote there, you know, in that part of the speech that talked about the war on poverty. So move on to the next slide. Now, question number two, what program was not created as part of the original war on poverty? Was it Head Start, Medicaid, Medicare, the Earned Income Tax Credit, Modern Food Stamp Program, the expansion of Social Security, the VISTA Program, Community Action, or the Child Nutrition Act? So of those nine choices, which one was not part of the original war on poverty? All right, if you scroll to the next slide, you'll see that the answer is D. The EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, was actually created under President Gerald Ford in 1975, and is actually is still one of our most effective anti-poverty programs. The rest of those programs that are listed, all of them came from the original War on Poverty under the Johnson administration, along with a host of other programs. Okay, quiz question number three. By how much did the War on Poverty initially reduce poverty in America? So the time the war on poverty started, what impact did it have on poverty in America at that point in time? Did it reduce it by one quarter, by one third, or by half? One quarter, one third, one half. And if you scroll to the next slide, you'll see the answer is C. The war on poverty actually cut the U.S. poverty rate in half, from 22% in 1960 to 11% by 1973. And if you want to see a great infographic, you know, a visual interpretation of the war on poverty, go to that link that's listed there on the slide. It's got a really good information about the programs that were created and its impact on the poverty rate. All right, question number four. Please rank these programs, 1 through 4, in order of effectiveness in reducing poverty. So number one is the most effective program at reducing poverty, and down through four. SNAP, unemployment benefits, Social Security, or the EITC and child tax credit? Can y'all whisper? A whisper. Okay, if you look at the answer on the next slide, you'll see that the answer is number one, Social Security lifted 26.6 million people out of poverty in 2012. EIT and CTC were next at 9.4 million, then SNAP at 5 million, and then UI, or unemployment, at 2.4 million. And according to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the safety net kept 41 million Americans out of poverty in 2012. That's the entire safety net, including 9 million children. So it's doing a lot of good. All right, next slide. Next question, number five. What are the overall U.S. poverty rate and U.S. child poverty rates in the United States? The 20, 15, and 22%, 10% and 15%, 5 and 8%, or 30 and 10%? If you look at the next slide, the answer to number five is A. Based on the most recent U.S. Census data, 15% of Americans were living in poverty in 2012, or about 46.5 million people. The child poverty rate was 21.8%, and that amounts to about 16 million children. Okay, question number six. What is the current poverty threshold for a family of four in the United States? Is it around 15,000? Is it close to 24,000? Is it more like $36,000 or $40,000? Which one of those? All right. If you look at the next slide, the answer is B. A family of four is considered living in poverty if they earn less than $23,850 in 2014. Now, according to the Economic Policy Institute, a family with two parents and two children needed to earn $48,778 to meet basic needs in 2008. So pretty much more than double of what the poverty rate is right now for that family. Okay, let's go to question number seven. The Earned Income Tax Credit does which of the following? It lifts more children out of poverty than any other program, improves a child's performance in school, improves a child's likelihood of attending college, or all of the above. All right, if you go to the next slide, you see the answer is D, all of the above. The EITC is one of our most effective anti-poverty tools. It lifts more children out of poverty than any other program and is second only to Social Security in lifting people overall out of poverty. And according to the Center on Budget, children who live in EITC households have a higher school test scores, are more likely to attend college, and work more hours and earn more income as adults. Okay, question number eight. What is the U.S. asset poverty rate? And asset poverty means if you're faced with a loss of income, the household would not have enough assets, cash, savings, investments, home, things like that, to live above the poverty line for more than 3 months. So what is the U.S. asset poverty rate? Is it 5%, 25%, 20%, or 13%? And if you look at the next slide, CFPB reports that it's answer B, 25%. Then in 2011, the asset poverty rate was a quarter of American households. The more astounding is that the liquid asset poverty rate, and these are assets that are cash or can be converted to cash quickly, was 43%. This means that nearly one-half of all Americans are only one financial away from crisis. One financial crisis away from poverty, I should say. Okay, question number nine. What is the impact of a child having a savings account in his or her name? One, A, orientation towards the future. B, 7 times more likely to attend college. C, 4 times more likely to graduate college. Or D, all of the above. And if you scroll to the next slide, you can see the answer is D. According to the Center for Social Development, children in low to moderate income households who have a savings account in his or her name are 7 times more likely to attend college and 4 times more likely to graduate than those who don't. Even having as little as $1 to start with has been shown to make a difference. All right, on to the final question, number 10. What is the idea that results supports that would help low-income families build savings? Is it A, the financial security credit, B, the saver's option, or C, the family savings account tax thing? And if you look at the next page, although many of us probably refer to it as the C's option, it's actually A, the financial security credit. That would help low-income families start saving. Taxpayers would simply check a box on their tax return designating that all or part of their refund would be deposited into a savings account. And if the taxpayer maintains that deposit for at least 8 months, the government would match it up to $500 a year. So it gives people the opportunity, the ease, and the incentive to actually start saving. And pilot programs like this have shown that people will actually take advantage of it and save. So, and you can actually urge your members of Congress to support the financial security credit using our online email alert. So, folks, we hope that this quiz has helped you get a better understanding of poverty in America and the U.S. and the war on poverty to be able to use this, use these facts in your op-eds and your advocacy in coming months. And, again, please contact us if you need help with drafting or editing or submitting your op-eds. And when you do get published, please let us know. We want to celebrate and make sure everybody can celebrate your success with you. So with that, I'm now going to turn it over to Myrdan Thompson in Louisville, who will do our share section. Myrdan, you there?
I am, can you talk?
Yep, go ahead.
Great. Hi, this is Myrdan Thompson. I'm the U.S. Poverty Organizer based in Louisville, Kentucky. I'm pleased today to do our share section. First, let's hear from Bruce Kessler in Chelmsford, Pennsylvania, who will tell us how he's been successful in getting op-eds published in his local paper. Bruce?
Hi, can you hear me? This is Bruce.
Yep, go ahead, Bruce.
Can you hear me? Okay, good. Well, see, I live in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, and I first got a letter to the editor published in my local newspaper in the early 1990s. One of my results partners and I went to an editorial board meeting. We got to meet the staff at the Public Opinion in Chambersburg, and we tried to get an editorial written, but they instead did a very nice interview of Abby, my partner, who was a Head Start expert. So that's how I got started, and I sent in letters to the editor before I ever did a op-ed, so they already knew that my letters were pretty carefully written. But our paper has a thing called guest essay. That's their op-ed. And I submit one now or a letter to the editor every couple of months. And although the staff has changed over the years, it's quite a bit, they still know my work because I keep sending stuff in. I appreciated Margot's comments on tips for writing op-eds, just like the rest of you. I know in mine for the content, I always include a mention of my congressman or my senators when I request them to do something, and that's every time. And I always refer to a news item that's appeared in the paper, so you kind of keep your eye on the paper. And I always try to have some local Chambersburg mention. It doesn't have to be big, but that's why they know it's local. And also, I have one other tip that is important for me. And I have a captive reader who isn't very well informed on our issues, but she knows how to read. It's my wife. And she gives me what I would call fearless feedback. And so I don't send anything in until she can read it and understand it. And that really helps. And the final thing, I just keep in mind that my op-ed's going to go in the same slot on the editorial page as those written by George Will, or E.J. Dionne, or Charles Krauthammer. Yes, sir. That's our paper. But sometimes I'm in there, too, and then I try to remember that I'm as professional as they are. But that's my experience.
That's great, Bruce. It sounds like you've done some wonderful relationship building throughout the years to be able to have such great opportunities for your thoughts about results to be shared. Now we're going to go to Tom Carson in Cincinnati. Hi, Tom, and he's going to share what his group is excited to accomplish based on their 2014 group plan. Go ahead, Tom.
Great. Thanks, Myrdan, and hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Please share.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, one of the things we're excited about is we just did it. And, you know, because when we first looked at it, you know, I looked at the summary planning sheets, and I thought, oh, this is for an advanced group. But, you know, I set all that aside. We just kind of put that to the side, and we just went down and did the plan the way it was laid out and had some really surprising results. So, you know, first of all, everyone took something on. So everyone took on a leadership in some area. And, you know, I didn't expect anyone to be on for going to the international conference. I don't know why I expected that, but that's kind of what I expected. And five of us are planning on going. So that was another unexpected result that we're excited about that came out of doing the plan. And, you know, then we took on not only expanding here in Cincinnati, but expanding in two other cities. And I think one of the things that really worked was it made the actions real. You know, we took actions today to include another city, and even though we weren't successful in doing that, I know that that's, you know, it was set up for the future, that we'll have Batesville, Indiana will be part of our group here in the near future. And so it made it very real, and it really gave us a direction to move in and what actions we're going to take as a group. So I appreciate the opportunity to share today, and look forward to an awesome year.
Great, Tom. I can't wait to see all of you in D.C. this summer. It's going to be fabulous, and work with you throughout the year.
Thank you.
Now is the time when we're going to go ahead to our roll call section. So, Judy, if you're available, please take over.
Hi, this is Judy Zobel from Des Moines. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Well, this is time for this month's roll call. So here are the questions we want you to answer this month. How many people are in the room, and how many op-eds will your group submit to a print or online media outlet this month? In a minute, the operator will begin calling your groups by city. When your city is called, simply answer the questions like this. Our numbers are 120 and 42, or more likely our numbers are 6 and 8. Remember, the operator will unmute your phone when your city is called, so you don't need to do anything to your phone. Again, the two questions are, how many people are in the room, and how many op-eds will your group submit to a print or online media outlet this month?
Okay, operator, you can go ahead and start the call.
Okay, we begin with Albuquerque.
Did we say Albuquerque?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And if it's possible, maybe we could do them alphabetical by state if it's easy to reorganize, just because that's the way I think our groups are used to it.
Okay, thank you a lot.
Well, it's Lene here, and I'm by myself today, so unfortunately I cannot answer those questions. Sorry. Everybody else in my group's in a different meeting today, so I'm just taking notes.
Okay, well, thanks for being on, and I hope you'll work with the group to go for it and share your story.
Yes, of course. Thank you.
Do we have them reorganized and then alphabetical by state? If we can't do that, that's fine. We'll just do it by
state. Yes, it is reorganized. I apologize.
Oh, no worries. Go ahead.
One moment. Los Angeles.
One and one.
North Hills.
And two.
Aurora.
Marty, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Two and two.
Stanford.
Two people, four op-eds.
Washington?
Two and four.
Chicago?
One and one.
Indianapolis?
One and one.
Des Moines?
Six and five.
Salina?
Our numbers are six and four.
Lindsborg?
Our numbers are two and one.
Louisville?
One and one.
New Orleans?
Three and nine.
And we have two from Baltimore.
Hi, this is Darby. One and one, and I know there's another Baltimore group meeting right now.
This is the other Baltimore. We got six and four.
Okay. One.
Detroit.
Our numbers are five and four.
St. Paul. St. Paul.
My numbers are two and two.
St. Louis.
Four and five.
Bernardsville. Bernardsville?
Is this on mute?
We can hear you now. Go ahead, Jeff.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Our numbers are four and two.
Thank you.
Albuquerque?
One and one for now.
Santa Fe?
We're seven and three.
Buffalo.
One and one.
Columbus.
Six and eight.
Cincinnati.
Six and three.
Chambersburg.
Following numbers are one and two.
Arlington.
Two and one.
And Falls Church.
One and one.
And that completes the roll call.
All right. Thank you for doing the roll call, Judy. This is Cindy Levin.
And hey, Cindy, let's get a quick total. I'm sorry, this is Meredith to interrupt, but hopefully Cynthia has the – I got 77 on the call. Cynthia, is that the number you got for the number of people on the call?
I have 76 and 73.
Okay, and 73 op-ed. Good luck, folks. And now we go to Cindy in St. Louis to close out our call.
All right. Well, I was just so excited to talk to you all. I'm not usually on this call, so this is Cindy King at Levin. I'm your fundraising coach. And I have an announcement about our 2014 Friends and Family campaign. We have listened to the grassroots, we've analyzed the data, and we have a brand new strategy to share with you for our 2014 Friends and Family. Instead of being a month-long effort, it will now be an ongoing campaign from February to October. Donations to Results or Results Educational Fund solicited by volunteers through fundraising, letter writing, emails, or web pages will count towards our overall $25,000 goal for personal fundraising appeals to friends and family. So why did we make the change? Mainly because participation in fundraising is changing. More of you are telling us that you're participating when it's best for your personal schedules. Many partners told us that they enjoy asking their friends to ask or to give when they have a personal connection, like when they celebrate a birthday, run a race for results, or ask around a holiday. like Thanksgiving. Our survey of the grassroots showed that there is no overall consensus about what would be a good time of year for a month-long friends and family campaign. So to help our groups and individual volunteers fundraise at convenient times, we'll support you if you want to do a mail letter campaign, or if you want to do a birthday campaign or raise money if you're getting married on our results celebration website, or take on a physical challenge with our results Race to End Poverty website. We'll also be creating seasonal online campaigns at three different times of the year, themed around Valentine's Day, the International Conference, and Thanksgiving. So right now, in February, the Valentine's Date Night In is our theme. And this campaign helps you to invite donors to stay in for the holiday and instead donate the cost of a dinner out as an expression of love for the world. So you can get started with that at www.tinyurl.com/2014resultslove. If you've participated in friends and family campaigns in the past, you can expect a phone call or email from our development staff to help explain the change and make sure you have all the support you need. Donor envelopes for the mail campaign or help setting up websites or just general coaching about how to make the most of your campaign are all available. So we'll help you choose a campaign that is exactly right for you. If you haven't participated in the past, please reach out to your fundraising coaches, either Jen DeFranco or me, Cindy Levin, and we'll be happy to get you started. So thank you to all our partners who annually volunteer their energy to collect thousands of dollars for Results or Results Educational Fund with this Friends and Family campaign. And we hope this new strategy will be more fun and successful to everyone. Just a last reminder that whenever you see your donors or if you want to reach out to them, thank them and tell them about some of these wonderful successes, like how many people we protected to keep SNAP program roles, that's a wonderful, it's always a wonderful time to do that. Meredith, shall I go ahead with the final announcements?
Yes, please do.
Great. So here we go to wrap up. Thank you to everyone who has completed and submitted your 2014 group plan. If you have not done so, please finish your group plans and send a copy to Jocelyn at jlinn@results.org. Just know, Joss is going to keep bugging you to send it in, so you might feel free to silence him by sending in your plan today. Results has a goal of expanding into new congressional districts. And in 2014, a team of Results Volunteer Regional Coordinators will have a goal of starting 10 new U.S. poverty groups. Join our February webinar on Wednesday, February 26th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, where we'll discuss how to tell stories about your involvement with Results and practice how to add a sense of urgency to our work when reaching out to others. Next, don't forget about the media support call Joss mentioned, which, again, is on Tuesday, February 18th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And now, if someone you know, or if it's you, would make the next great results advocate, please invite them to dial into one of our bi-monthly results introductory calls. Our February calls are this Wednesday, February 12th at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and Friday, February 28th. At 1 p.m. Eastern Time. The next results U.S. poverty-free agents calls will be Tuesday, February 18th at 1 p.m. Eastern Time and 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We're doing them on the same day again because of the President's Day holiday. Don't forget to register for the 2014 Results International Conference. We are looking forward to another great conference this year, so make your plans today. You can register on the Results website. You can find a full list of upcoming events along with call-in numbers and registration links on the Results Events calendar. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being on the call today. The next Results U.S. Poverty National Conference call is Saturday, March 8th at 12:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And operator, please open up the phone lines and let's wish each other a very happy early Valentine's Day.